content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is All About Pets. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Yahoo Life, Hapster.com, Smithsonian Magazine, and Dogster Magazine. We'll start today's All About Pets with an article titled, Six Secret Cues That Cats Use to Communicate with Each Other, from Yahoo Life. Cats are known to cuddle up to their owners as a way, among many others, to communicate and even signify comfort. When it comes to felines voicing how they feel with fellow cats, however, that's a little trickier to decode. I feel like these are cues, like meowing, most often seen with cats that have been socialized either with other cats, pets, or with humans, says Dr. Yolanda A. Markley, a doctor who has a doctorate of veterinary medicine, an associate director at Banfield Pet Hospital. They have been able to experience a range of interactions where they have been able to determine what makes them comfortable and what doesn't. If you want the cats in your household to communicate more, it's best to ease into the process, like by familiarizing each other's scents or introducing them through a divider to establish a common ground, explains Dr. Andrea Y. Too, doctorate of veterinary medicine, the medical director of Behavior Vets of New York, and a resident at American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. In the event that you simply want to know what feline communication signals mean when you do see them interact, stay tuned. Here, our veterinarians break down all the commonly used cues. Meowing. Adult cats actually do not usually communicate in an auditory spectrum that we can hear, reveals Dr. Too. They are in ultrasonic spectrums. While they use this silent code between one another, cats, especially kittens, do also meow to communicate. They will meow to mother cats, adds Dr. Too. When you look at how cats use verbal cues to communicate with each other, it's like a child-mother relationship with the meowing coming from the child. Meowing is not to be mistaken for chirping, though, a choppy bird-like sound that cats can use as a friendly greeting to fellow pets. She also notes that cats use this sound to indicate that they are looking at prey. Hissing. Hissing would be a verbal cue that a cat is bothered, in fear, or uncomfortable, shares Dr. Markley. Plus, this communication can also serve as a way to create boundaries between felines. When you communicate in a hissing noise and when you are fearful, you are asking for space from what is scaring you, adds Dr. Too. So, a hiss is trying to scare something away because you yourself are very scared, or you are trying to request increased distance. Oftentimes, cats will growl before hissing as a way to make themselves heard, and then they up the ante and hiss to show that they are scared and want more separation. Purring. Dr. Markley explains that purring is a sign to cats, and humans, of course, that they are comfortable, feeling affectionate, and relaxed. This is also used often by kittens to help them communicate their needs with the mother cat. Soft eyes mean that a cat is happy. Dr. Too mentions that a slow blink is a sign of comfort around another feline. However, cats avoiding eye contact altogether likely is indicating to another that they are feeling mildly anxious. In addition, Dr. Too says that partially dilated pupils mean the same thing. Cats often dilate their pupils for hunting purposes, especially if it's dark. This allows more light into their eyes so they can scan an area before it gets dim. Kneading. When you see your cat kneading near another feline, this is also a good sign. Dr. Markley explains that kneading something with their paws, often called making biscuits, means they are happy and relaxed. They exude the same emotions when they rub their head or body against another cat. Stiff body language. Ears that are out to the side and are kind of pushed back flat against the head, sometimes called airplane ears, are the ears of a really scared cat, says Dr. Too. Tight body language, particularly in the back and shoulders, are also indicators of fear to other felines. You think of that typical Halloween cat image, where their back is arched, their legs are crouched under their body, and they're ready to run, adds Dr. Too. They've made their back big. This is a continuation of the discussion of fear. You want to make yourself look big and scary so the scary thing doesn't approach you. Keep your eyes on the cat's tail. A fast-moving tail usually means fear and anxiety, whereas a tail held high over the body, almost curled forward toward the head, is a friendly greeting sign. The tail is pointing straight up and twitching, though. That means the cat is about to spray urine or mark something. Now we'll move on to Catster magazine. And we'll read an article from the Catster tips section. This is near and dear to my heart because I have two orange tabbies myself. So this is the Orange Tabby Cat, 8 Fun Facts by Denise LeBeau. We've compiled a few facts about the orange tabby cat that address common questions like, are all orange cats tabbies? And are all the orange tabby cats male? Morris and Garfield are just a few of the iconic orange tabby cats that are part of our culture's collective cat consciousness. It's not hard to know why. Their big, bold, and brightly colored coats is one reason. But as anyone who's lived with an orange tabby cat can attest, it's really their personalities that make them stars. They're infinitely fascinating felines, so here are 8 fun facts about the awesome orange tabby cat. 1. First, the truth about tabbies. It's actually a coat pattern, not a breed. Specifically, the presence of stripes denotes a tabby cat, and there are 5 different tabby configurations. Classic tabby, mackerel tabby, spotted tabby, tick tabby, and patch tabby. 2. All orange cats are tabbies. Go ahead, Google orange cats. They're all tabbies. Even if their stripes are faint, they're there. So while all orange cats are tabbies, not every tabby is orange. 3. Is every orange tabby cat male? While it's true that a higher percentage of orange tabbies are male, the ratio is actually about 80% male to 20% female. And it's not some sort of magic, it's genetics. The X chromosome is responsible for the orange coloring. Females possess 2 X's and males possess XY. Hence, a female orange tabby requires the sire and the dam to pass on the orange genes. But males only need 1 orange gene from their mothers. What does the orange tabby cat M stand for? One of the most distinctive markings on the orange tabby cat is the M above his eyes. This is seen in all types of tabbies, so it's not just the orange kitties that boast these cool peeper accoutrements. Tabby stripes are probably predominant because of their camouflage properties. It's most likely their markings help them hide in the world. Depending on the orange tabby's parental decor choices, this may or may not be the case for the modern tabby. 5. Orange tabbies tend to talk a lot. National Geographic reports that personality is tied to a cat's coat color. Guess who won anecdotally most gregarious? Of course, every cat's personality is different, but Amy Wester has lived with many different cats over the years, and Momo, short for you know it, Motormouth, is a testament to the findings. He's the most affectionate and happiest cat, says Amy. When we rescued him 11 years ago, his constant loud purring could be heard throughout the house. His name is fitting, and even more so today. Momo hasn't stopped purring since we got him. 6. Orange tabbies are known for being Velcro cats. Every cat is an individual, but orange cats have a reputation for being snuggly attention lovers. In addition to being a real purr machine, Momo the orange tabby cat seeks affection every waking hour from Amy and then some. His frequent, less than stealthy move is to climb up onto her pillow and start climbing around her head for attention. Makes no difference whether she's awake or not. Karen Stevenson echoes these sentiments. Her house has been filled with all sorts of companion animals for 2 decades, and yet there's one snuggle monster who's in the most in-your-face when seeking some loving. Since the first day my husband brought home Tiger, he's been the most loving animal, says Karen. Even 18 years later, Tiger's nightly habit of sleeping on her head is only broken when she's traveling. He also likes to sit down and stare at Karen's husband, Brett. I don't know why he does it, but it's part of what makes him so adorable. 7. Winston Churchill famously owned an orange tabby cat. Maybe it's a little too fitting that the man who said never, never, never give up owned an orange tabby cat. That's right, Winston Churchill shared his life with an orange tabby cat called Tango. He was probably just trying to get some sleep in his own bed when he came up with the famous line. 8. Orange tabbies are the color of appetite. What? The psychology of colors arguably started with Goethe. His writing asserts that red yellow is associated with warmth and gladness. He also claimed that yellow-red possesses the highest energy, apparently causing folks in Days of Yore to freak out if they saw an orangey cloak on a dreary day. Contemporary findings include that orange is the color of adventure, social communication, and yes, stimulating the appetite. Howard Johnson was onto something. While it may be a broad brush to paint all tabbies in, we can see that there's definitely an anecdotal correlation between their coat colors and their personalities. Now we know exactly why Garfield couldn't resist that lasagna. So whether they're trying to hog the pillow so you'll wake up and pet them, or purring up a storm so you'll pick them up and pet them, there's one thing we know for sure. Orange tabby cats are bright, beautiful, and varied as their coats. We'll move on to another article from Catster.com titled Sanctuaries for Seniors by Sandy Robbins. Special retirement homes and sanctuaries offer senior cats who have lost their loved ones a permanent, homey environment to comfortably live out their golden years. In every respect, they go above and beyond for elderly felines. The Bluebell Foundation for Cats. The Bluebell Foundation for Cats nestles on the green hillside on the winding Laguna Canyon Road in Laguna Beach, California. It can accommodate 60 residents and offers care to senior felines in a tranquil forever home setting, thanks to animal lover Bertha Yergat, who founded the organization and willed her beautiful Laguna Canyon property to it in the late 1980s. Pamela Knudsen, who handles communications for the organization, says, "There's a designated feline dining room and spacious sleeping and napping accommodations throughout. The home with special perching places, a bunk bed, sofas, all with steps for easy access, especially for cats with arthritis. There's also a special section of the property reserved for cats with special medical needs. And safe outdoor enclosed areas allow the cats to nap in sunshine and enjoy the sounds of nature. Most residents come to Bluebell when their pet parents pass away," Pamela explains. "A lifetime care program fee per cat is $7,500, which covers housing, medical care, food, and lots of love from staff and volunteers. Cats have also come to us when their pet parents move to an assisted living housing or who are sick and can no longer care for their pets. We also provide a forever home for unadoptable senior cats with special needs," she adds. The Community Cat Fund underwrites costs for the unadoptable senior shelter that come to live at Bluebell. More at bluebellcats.org. Hearts That Purr Feline Guardians. Jean Marie Schiller McGinnis, founder and president of Hearts That Purr Feline Guardians, purchased an 8-acre property in Tucson, Arizona in 2013 that backs onto a desert landscape. This feline retirement center is currently home to 25 cats. The organization also oversees senior cats living in private homes as part of their Senior Kittizens Foster Care Program. Jean Marie explains, "They are not adopting the cat. Ownership of the cat remains with Hearts That Purr, and we maintain responsibility for all veterinary care, including transportation. Initially, we supply all the essentials a new cat needs, such as a litter box, scratching post, food bowls, and toys. Essentially, in terms of our foster care agreement, the foster parent is providing a safe home, a warm lap, love and attention for one of our felines for the rest of its life. Hearts That Purr Feline Guardians only accepts elderly cats who have become homeless due to their owner's death, illness, or incapacitation. We'll also step in when a cat has already been surrendered to a municipal shelter. The average age of residents is 17, while the oldest resident to date was 24. Learn more at heartsthatpurr.org. Cat's Cradle Shelter. The Cat's Cradle Shelter in Fargo, North Dakota, has a long-term care foster program for senior cats to live out their care in the comfort of a typical domestic setting. The carers of our senior cats are given whatever they need for the cats in their care, such as low-entry litter boxes, steps, or thick beds, says co-founder and executive director Gail Ventsky. "There's a resident senior named Burbank, who is our office cat at the shelter," Gail says. "She's nearly 20 years old and in kidney failure. When she came to us, our veterinarian said she didn't think she'd survive a week because she was so sick and so thin. That was a year and a half ago. She still is happily camping out in her bed next to all the main desk, loved and very spoiled by all. Cat's Cradle operates on donations, which also cover their high specialty veterinary diets and medication bills. Check out catscradleshelter.org. Bell Glen Sanctuary. Established 20 years ago, the sanctuary is home to 35 to 40 cats. Two-thirds of the current residents are over 12 years of age, and four of them are 16. Bell Glen will adopt cats under special circumstances, but most of them have health problems and are not really adoptable, explains Donna Kemp, president of Bell Glen. "Typically, we're dealing with kidney failure, chronic bowel syndrome, stomatitis, chronic heart failure, diabetes, and arthritis. Like other senior feline residences, the sanctuary focuses on creature comforts with ramps for easy access to litter boxes and cat furniture of different heights, along with a wide range of washable cat beds. To help cover costs, the sanctuary has sponsors for individual cats for whom they receive individual information and pictures. The website also details how to buy and sell on eBay and benefit the sanctuary, as well as designating them as an organization of choice on Amazon Smile. More at BellGlenSanctuary.com. Milo's Sanctuary and Special Needs Cat Rescue. Cats come to us from all walks of life. 11th hour rescues from shelters where they've been listed for euthanasia to being flown to us from Egypt, Turkey, and even Mexico, says Michelle Hoffman, president of Milo's Sanctuary, Inc., also known as True Heart Haven in Burbank, California. We often work with other local rescues that have a special needs cat, and we'll give them two of our adoptable cats in exchange for one of their special needs cats. Michelle explains that it gives the adoptable cats a chance at finding forever homes, freeing up space at a rescue that may not be able to deal with long-term special needs. Senior residents are about 16 and older. A team provides ramps for cats to access couches and windowsills, as well as low-entry litter boxes. Two fully enclosed catios are accessible to all the special needs or elderly cats. They can go safely outside, bathe in the sunshine, and listen to birds. The organization operates solely on donations. More at milosanctuary.org. Next, we'll move on to an article from SmithsonianMagazine.com, Smithsonian Voices. Meet the Scientist Studying How Dogs Evolve from Predator to Pet, by Emily LeClerc. Thousands of years ago, dogs as we know them didn't exist. Instead, humans and wolves lived separate lives while inhabiting the same lands. Eventually, their proximity evolved into what companionship we have today. But despite the long history between humans and dogs, scientists are still unsure of how this friendship began. For National Puppy Day, which was in March, we chatted with Audrey Lynn, a Peter Buck postdoctoral fellow and evolutionary molecular biologist at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, to learn about how humans of the past helped build the bond between us and our favorite furry friends. What is domestication, and how do dogs become household pets? Domestication is when humans take reproductive control over another species and direct its reproduction in a certain way. The scenario we imagine is that, at some point, there was a wolf that wasn't as scared of humans as the other wolves, and it started creeping closer to human settlements to seek food. Then it went on from there. It was a mutual relationship between humans and a precursor to the dog in the beginning. How do you study the history of our relationship with our four-legged friends? There's two ways of going about it. We can look at either mitochondrial genomes or whole genomes. Mitochondrial genomes, or the genetic information found in mitochondria, are much easier to recover because they are much shorter. We're talking about 16,000 base pairs versus billions of base pairs. There are markers in mitochondrial genomes that allow us to answer questions about dogs and ancient dog-like carnivores on a population level. But mitochondrial genomes are only a fragment of the complete picture. There's a lot of demographic information that you can't infer from mitochondrial DNA. If we're lucky enough to recover whole new genomes from ancient dogs, then we can get a much bigger picture of the complexities of their evolutionary history in relation to many different populations. This includes admixture, which involves interbreeding with different populations, and introgression, which involves multiple instances of hybridizing with a different species, like the gray wolf. We can look at certain genes and certain traits that developed in a given population. There are so many different factors you can look at with a whole genome that you can't just with mitochondrial DNA. Do domesticated animals have common traits? There are certainly traits which are seen as most universal in many animals. Things like tamer behavior, a smaller brain, floppy ears, a curly tail, and changes in skin and fur pigmentation like spots. They allow us to differentiate between what's wild and what's considered domesticated. There's a lot of debate as to why these traits are seen in all the different kinds of animals we've domesticated, not just dogs. It's likely that when genes involved with domestication are expressed, they also manifest with these different traits that are not seen in their wild ancestors. It's almost like a cute byproduct. What makes dogs different from other domesticated animals? Dogs are unique in comparison to other domesticated animals because it appears that their breeding with its wild relative was restricted. If you look at ancient dog genomes, there is gene flow from dogs to wolves, but not the other way around, which is very unusual. If you look at early domesticated pigs, they mixed with wild boar all the time. The same is true for goats and sheep. This probably has to do with the special relationship humans have with dogs. We live much more closely with them, and the behaviors we want in dogs are much more restrictive. You don't want your dog to breed with a wolf and then have puppies that are more fearful of people. inspired you to become an evolutionary molecular biologist and study dog domestication? I came to ancient DNA and working with dogs in a non-straightforward way. My background is primarily genetics, virology, and microbiology. During my PhD at Oxford, I had the opportunity to work with Dr. Gregor Larson, who researches evolutionary genomics, ancient DNA, and domestication. At the time, he and his group had written a paper that put forward some evidence that there may have been two origins of dog domestication instead of one. It was rather controversial, and I was really excited to work with them. I'm still working with Gregor and other collaborators from that group on ancient dogs. I've always been attracted to the idea of looking at archaeological remains or historical remains as time capsules to understand our genetic past. It's incredible what technology can allow us to recover when it comes to ancient DNA. Ancient dogs and domestication became more and more interesting the more I realized how little we know and how little information we have. What is your relationship? What has your research taught about our relationship with dogs today? For me, it makes me feel more connected to the humans from the past. Dogs were most likely domesticated more than 20,000 years ago, and it's quite cool and humbling to look back at the really intimate and loving relationships that people 20,000 years ago had with their dogs, especially since people have the same relationship with their dogs today. Also, learning more about ancient dogs and domestication makes us better to appreciate dogs today. It's seeing that our continuity of our close relationship to dogs. Do you have a dog? I currently live with a retired Smithsonian curator, and she has a dog named Pip. I had dogs as a kid, but before Pip, I never had a close relationship with a dog before. With Pip, who's a border collie mix, I now really understand people's obsession with dogs. The sensitivity that Pip has to other humans and how incredibly smart he is really amazing. It brings me closer to what I'm studying. I've never felt like that in all my years of being a biologist. For example, I also study viruses, and I find them endlessly fascinating on an intellectual level. But the emotion you associate with something intellectually interesting versus having a real personal relationship with a representative of a species you're studying is so different. It's something new and quite cool to me. Next, we'll move on to Dogster Magazine. Well, Miss Manners for this month, Helping Your Dog Through Big Challenges by Victoria Stilwell. The pandemic has completely disrupted our lives and changed the way we do things, thrusting us into a way of life for which we were totally unprepared. The resulting stress has been difficult to manage, but after months of adjusting, most people have adapted to the new normal and found creative ways to navigate the changing landscape. It can be stressful when situations change, even when we understand what's going on. Our dogs don't have that luxury and are often blindsided by the disappearance of a best canine buddy or human friend. When a life-altering event happens, such as the death of a family member, a child leaving for college, or the arrival of a baby, dogs find themselves at a complete loss, wondering what just happened. If you find yourself facing major changes, there are ways to help your dog while you also negotiate the challenges. Loss of a loved one. When a loved one dies, your dog might grieve the loss of her canine buddy or person. If she sleeps more, loses interest in food, or resists your attempts to engage in play, she's most likely in mourning. The best thing you can do is keep her routine as consistent as possible while ensuring she does not spend too much time by herself. Keep all the dog beds in the same place so that the scent of your dog that has passed is still there. Give your dog plenty of attention so she doesn't feel alone. If your dog loses her appetite, add tasty morsels to her meals and warm the food up to make it more enticing. If she always ate at the same time as her canine buddy, take your old dog's place and eat at the same time she does. Social eating shows trust and is a habitual and comforting activity. Most dogs are sensitive to human emotions and will pick up on their loved one's sadness, sometimes offering consolation behavior in return. If your dog adores the teenager who is about to go to college or leaves home for another reason, make the transition easier by starting the disconnection process a month or so before the change happens. Have another family member take over your dog's day-to-day care, including feeding and walking. Your dog sleeps on your child's bed, change the sleeping arrangements in advance, and have your child take a step back and pay your dog a little less attention. A new addition. Probably the most stressful sudden change is the arrival of a baby. For years, the dog has enjoyed a quiet life with her family, receiving attention wherever she needs it, and then out of the blue, a new being arrives, making a lot of noise and smelling very different. Help your dog adjust by preparing for the baby well in advance. Buy a recording of baby sounds and introduce these sounds softly to begin with, increasing the level once your dog habituates to the noise. Purchase a baby doll and walk around with it like you do when the baby arrives. Practice changing diapers, walking with a stroller, and making your dog feel good when the baby doll is present. When the time comes, keep everyone safe by never leaving your baby unattended with your dog at any time, not even to go to the bathroom. Get outside. Whatever changes occur, the best medicine for your dog is exercise. Walking, sniffing, and experiencing the outside world makes everyone feel better. The more you can engage your dog's brain activities that physically and mentally stimulate her, the less confused and anxious she will be. Exercise releases pleasurable endorphins into the body, giving a feeling of well-being. Engaging your dog in team activities such as dog sports benefits both of you. Adding another dog can also help after an appropriate period of time and your existing dog is no longer grieving. However, pick a dog that complements the one you already have to ensure the two enjoy each other's company. If the pandemic has taught us anything, is that life is precious and change can happen in a moment. The more confident your dog is, the easier it will be for her to cope with any changes that come her way. Giving your dog a humane canine education and understanding her unique needs will help all of you negotiate life's challenges. We'll finish this month's episode with a little bit of legal talk. So, Denver repeals pit bull ban. Voters made their voices heard last November when they voted to approve ballot measure 2J. As of 2021, it's no longer illegal to own a pit bull in the city of Denver, Colorado. The new law ends a citywide pit bull ban that has been in place since 1989. Under the new law, pit bull owners must apply for a special license for their dog. If after 3 years no behavioral incidents have been documented, the special license is no longer needed and the owner may register the dog with the city. Service dogs only. The Department of Transportation ruled in December that dogs are the only animals that may be defined as service animals. The new definition of service animals is a dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability. Emotional support animals are not considered service animals, but service dogs may be defined as psychiatric service animals. The ruling means that airlines may prohibit emotional support animals that are not service dogs from flying in the cabin and may require proof and training and behavior of service dogs prior to flying. We've run out of time for today's episode of All About Pets. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. All About Pets is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.